Let's go to the book of Exodus, chapter 19. We are now at the second major part of three parts of the book of Exodus. The first emphasis, and most of you have been with it, has been in Exodus chapters 1 through 18, and we simply molded that around the word, the Exodus, both anticipated, the resistance to it, and how it became effected. The mid part of the book that we're at now, of course, is the law. And that begins in chapter 19 and goes through the end of chapter 24. Then, of course, the final part focuses and centers around the tabernacle. And that is in chapter 25 through the end of the book, or chapter 40. And so we're now ready to come to the mid part of the book of Exodus, or the giving of the law. And by way of introduction to it, we need to see several things before we get into its actual content. And by way of introduction, the first thing to note is its function. How does it affect the national life of Israel? And its function can be defined very simply as this. Its function is to define and specify Israel's relationship to the Lord. It defines and specifies Israel's relationship to God. What that relationship is to be and how it is to function. The function of the law is to define and specify Israel's relationship to God. We speak of it as the Mosaic Covenant. Second, after we look at its function, there is a structure as to how her constitution is put together. And it revolves about three key words. God gave in the law to Israel, number one, commandments. God gave to Israel, number two, judgments. And God gave to Israel, number three, ordinances. And we can organize the basic teaching in the Constitution around those three parts. The commandments affected Israel's moral life. And it is found in chapters 19 and 20. The moral absolutes on which the nation was to operate are expressed in chapters 19 and 20. We'll get into some of them tonight. The judgments did not so much concern Israel's moral life as they concerned Israel's social life. And the judgments regulating her social life are in chapters 21 through 23. Social life, we're talking about the relationship between a master and a servant. We're talking about domestic relationships. Relationships among the people themselves socially are found in that section. Then, third, you have the ordinances. And the ordinances had to do with worship, or they bore on Israel's spiritual life. And that takes in chapter 24 and brings us down to the end of the law. So we'll basically organize it around these three areas. Notice how complete the Constitution regulates the life of Israel, what they are to be personally in their moral condition, how they're to relate to one another socially, and how they relate vertically to God or their spiritual life. And we'll find all of this expanded later on in the Pentateuch, but nonetheless, these are all what we have in the section we're coming to right now. All right? That is the structure of the law. Third, what is the purpose of God giving Israel the law? What is its purpose? And we'll see that revolving about three things. The first purpose is to reveal to Israel God's absolute standards of righteousness. Number one, to reveal God's absolute standards of righteousness. Emphasis is on absolute standards. For that, take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy 4. Deuteronomy is very much a commentary on the history of Israel. And in chapter 4, Moses is encouraging the people to obey God's laws, and his method for encouraging people is to show them the enormous spiritual possessions that she has. And therefore, he is enumerating divine provisions, and he points out two great blessings that made Israel different than any other nation on the face of God's earth. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 7 records the first one. The first thing that makes Israel unique and different than any other nation was the personal presence of God. No other nation had anything like this. The personal presence of God, and the emphasis in Moses' teaching is going to be on the nearness and the responsiveness of God. He is very close, and not only is he very close, he's very sensitive and responsive to them. And notice the way that reads in chapter 4 of Deuteronomy, verse 7 and 8. Verse 7? Well, let's get 6 to really get the context. He encouraged them and says, "So keep and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the people, who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" And here's what makes Israel unique, the first of two things. "For what nation is there that has a God so near it as the Lord our God whenever we call on him?" And so notice with the word "so near to it" emphasize the nearness of God, and "whenever we call on him" emphasizes the responsiveness of God. And no other nation had any other God like that. This is only the God of Israel. That's the first thing that makes her unique. The second thing that made Israel totally different from any other nation on God's earth was, number two, the possession of the Word of God, or the possession of God's absolutes, God's truth. And that is spelled out by Moses in the following verse, verse 8. "What great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole law which I am setting before you today?" And so the possession of God's truth is simply saying there is no other nation anywhere that has what Israel has in the Word of God. And therefore, the thing that divides really humanity into two classes is those that operate and possess God's absolute standards and those that operate by their own standards. And that's true today. That's basically the difference between you as a believer and people you work with, because you're relating your life, or attempting to relate your life, to an absolute standard of God's truth. And the unbeliever out there is simply using all kinds of codes, what's convenient, what makes people like you, and all kinds of relative things that differ from person to person. We possess something very, very absolute in the Word of God, and we ought to be very, very grateful for it. And so that's the first reason, then, is to give God's absolute standards of righteousness to Israel. Let's look at that a couple of other places. Psalm 19, verse 7. Psalm 19, verse 7. We'll simply read them, but they are verses that comment on this same idea. 19. Now, when we talk about the law, there is one word that we ought to be sure is in our vocabulary, because we will be using it. The Hebrew word for law, and you probably know it, the Hebrew word for law is Torah, spelled in English T-O-R-A-H. The Torah is made up of the five books of Moses. Genesis through Deuteronomy is the Torah. All right? And we're just now getting introduction into God's revelation of the Torah, or his instructions. Psalm 19. "The Torah of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul." And then you have synonyms for Torah. "The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true. They are righteous altogether. Notice moral, true, absolutes. Psalm 119, 142 makes a similar statement. And it all fits under the idea that God is revealing absolute principles of righteousness. 119, 142. Thy righteousness is everlasting righteousness, and thy Torah is truth. Notice the emphasis on absolute truth in the context. And so, the second purpose then of the law is this: to expose or to identify and expose sin. To identify and expose sin. Why would sin need to be identified and exposed? And the answer to that is man is fallen and his conscience is perverted, and consequently any unguided definition or identification of sin on man's part is going to be affected by his sin nature. Paul emphasizes this aspect of the law repeatedly. Look at it in three places. Romans 3:20. To Paul, this is a very major thing as far as the law is concerned. Look at spot three places in Romans. And Paul categorically states this second purpose of the law. Verse 20, because by works of the law no flesh shall be justified in his sight, for through the law, that would be the Torah, through the Torah comes the knowledge of sin. Chapter 5 of the same book and verse 20. And the law came in that the transgression might increase. And then finally, Paul's own testimony in Romans chapter 7, verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. So very clearly, we're getting a constitution in the Old Testament. It's going to identify and expose sin. Third purpose. This is probably as big as any: to reveal God's holiness. To reveal God's holiness. Give us absolute moral standards, number one. Identify and expose sin, number two. To reveal God's holiness, number three. Now you can come at that from two different angles. One of them, you can come at it from the angle of the symbol of holiness in the Old Testament. And the symbol, inevitably, is fire. Or you can come at it at a second angle, and that you can come at it from the standpoint of the prohibitions that are put on approaching God. The prohibitions on approach. And as the righteousness of God is about to be revealed, both of those things will come into the picture. Go to Exodus 19, where we're about to enter into the law. And notice associated with the presence of God is fire. Verse 18, Mount Sinai was all in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And fire inevitably has to do with the holiness of God. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. Then you have the same thing in chapter 24 and verse 17. Very colorful verse where God appears to the people. And it says, to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So you can come at it from the standpoint of it reveals God's holiness, and it is made very vivid by the presence of fire. It's also made vivid that God is holy, and that the first lesson basically taught by the holiness of God is keep away. The basic message brought down in Exodus 19 is, because I am holy, you keep your distance. Don't you dare come into the presence of God because it will kill you. Because God is emphasizing the sinfulness of man and teaching them that you dare not approach God in your own way. For that, notice some of the strict prohibitions. Chapter 19, verse 10. The Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people, and you shall set bounds." This is not the idea of God saying, "I'm going to appear, y'all come." Not at all. You set bounds for the people all around. Set up police lines or barricades. Set bounds for all the people all around, saying, "Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain." I don't know whether that ever got anybody or not, but you know there are the kind of people that just love to play close to the edge. You ever met that kind, or are you that kind? You really don't, but you like to see how close you can get. Can you imagine the human nature, the people that, there's the boundary, and see how close I can get my foot without touching it and getting zapped. People being people, I would just have to think that somebody had to try it. But we have no record of such. Verse 21. This is the message of God's holiness. This has been a very embarrassing moment for the people who said, or who taught, you can come to God in your own way. Doesn't quite sound that way. Verse 21, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, 'Go down, warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them.' Moses said to the Lord, 'The people cannot come out to Mount Sinai, for thou didst warn us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it,'" and so forth. And so the people, the basic message is God is going to make his approach, and he is a holy God, and because he is a holy God, you cannot approach him as you wish. The question that would naturally be coming out of that would be, well, if we can't approach God, is there any solution to it? And the sacrificial system will come along and give us the answer to that. All right, the next introductory thing, and this is really important. What is the relationship of this new Mosaic covenant to the Abrahamic covenant? What is the relationship of the Mosaic covenant to the Abrahamic covenant? Now, let's put, first of all, something down about the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant had two basic features that we need to be sure we understand. Number one, in the Abrahamic covenant, we find out the ground of Abraham's salvation was faith. The ground of Abraham's salvation was faith. The responsibility of Abraham's salvation was obedience. Not until you came to a faith salvation does the issue of obedience rise. Now let's associate that with some passages. Genesis 15 and Genesis 17. What we want to do is see what's involved just in two basic things in the Abrahamic covenant, and then we'll see how it relates to this new covenant. Chapter 15, verse 5, "He, God, took him, Abraham, outside and said, 'Now look toward the heavens, count the stars, and if you're able to count them, and he said to them, so shall your descendants be.' Then he believed in the Lord, and he, the Lord, counted it to him for righteousness." That is the ground of Abraham's salvation. He believed what God promised in the covenant, and the ground of his salvation was faith. Now, the issue shifts, and the issue now becomes the issue of, since I do have salvation by faith, What is my responsibility? And notice that is obedience if you look at chapter 17. Verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. So those are two basic things on which the Abrahamic covenant rests. Now, how does this new Mosaic covenant, how does it tie in to the Abrahamic covenant? Does it change it? Does it cancel it? Does it expand it? What does it do? Well, there are two basic things to see. Number one, the law, or the Abrahamic covenant, or the Mosaic covenant, number one, was added to the Abrahamic covenant. The Mosaic covenant was added to that. Galatians 3:19. I shouldn't use the word to. That's a little bit misleading. It was added alongside. Added to looks as though it's an appendix, perhaps on the end, and I don't mean that. It was added alongside the Abrahamic covenant. Let's use that word. It was added alongside the Abrahamic covenant. Galatians 3, verse 19, makes this very clear. As Paul interprets the relationship of the law, verse 19. Why the law then? It was, and what's the word? Added. And then he gives the reason why it was added. It was added because of, and if you have your New American Standard, go out there into the margin with verse 19, and they do very well at an interpretation by saying, why the law then? It was added for the sake of defining transgressions. And that's the idea. It was added in order to define transgressions or to mark them off. And so the idea is there's something that the Abrahamic covenant couldn't do. And the thing that it did not do was to outline what is sin. And so God comes along with this covenant and adds it. Now think of it this way. Think of the Abrahamic covenant as a long, unbroken line. This is the Abrahamic covenant. Now, when we come to Exodus 19, put in a parallel line like this, and it is called the Mosaic covenant. And therefore, what effect did it have on the Abrahamic covenant? And the answer to that is it didn't have any effect on the Abrahamic covenant. It was brought in alongside the Abrahamic covenant said you need to have salvation and you can only have salvation by faith. And if men didn't know what sin was, why would they have any need for salvation? And so God says, all right, we're going to come along here and I'll put in the Mosaic call that will drive people to faith for salvation. They will see by this the utter hopelessness of meeting God's standards, and this in turn will cause them to flee to the Lord for salvation. Did it work out that way? No, man is more perverse than that. Man thought the Mosaic covenant was a ladder with one end in his backyard and the other end reaching to heaven, and that's the way you got to heaven, and therefore he completely forgot the Abrahamic covenant and totally misused it in the Old Testament. So what it was intended to do, and the way things worked out, of course, are two different things, and not God's fault, but because of the perversity of man. But keep them parallel to that in that way. The second relationship that is basic, number one, it was added alongside the Abrahamic covenant. And now next, the Mosaic covenant did not invalidate. Mosaic covenant did not invalidate the Abrahamic covenant at all. The Mosaic of the Abrahamic covenant was just as valid when we come to Exodus 19, 20, and 21 as it was previously. And if we're still in the book of Galatians, we've got that explanation there in chapter 3. And that's back to verses 17 and 18. Verse 17, what I'm saying is this. The law, which came 430 years later, that is after the Abrahamic covenant, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God, so as to nullify the promise. For if the promise is based on the law, it is no longer based on a promise, but God granted it to Abraham by means of a promise. It does not invalidate it at all. Now, granted, many Israelites treated the Mosaic covenant as though it did invalidate it. But Israel was horribly wrong at that particular point. All right? Very important, then, to keep that relationship clear in our minds. All right, next point of introduction. And I've tried to select what I think are the three major things that Israel did in the Old Testament in breaking God's law. So let's just make E in our introduction, how Israel broke it. There are three major sins that Israel committed in the Old Testament, along with others, but I think these above all have to be the ones that are chief. As you know, Israel was taken into captivity as a judgment for 70 years. And that 70-year captivity was a captivity basically for one fundamental national sin. What was it? The first thing we need to know. They totally violated the Sabbath year. Totally. Now, the way the Sabbath year worked out was after every 6 years, in the seventh year, the ground was to lie fallow. Go to Exodus chapter 25 for that. I mean Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25. This is the sin for which the captivity judgments came about. Chapter 25, and we'll look at the first five verses. The Lord spoke then to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap. Your grapes of trim vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And Israel didn't keep a sabbatical year even once. Total disobedience as far as that issue was concerned. She never, ever kept it. Now, in connection with that, there's an interesting prophecy and a fulfillment or explanation. And the prophecy is found in Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 11. And the fulfillment of it is in 2 Chronicles, chapter 36, verses 20 and 21. And why this, how this comes about, let's take a look. First of all, Jeremiah 25. And verse 11. Now, first you have the prophecy that involves two things. Well, three things, really. The whole land is going to be a desolation and a horror. These nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. So you've got the nature of the captivity, desolation and horror. You've got the nation of the captivity, Babylon. And you've got the time of the captivity, 70 years. Now, 2 Chronicles tells us how that got fulfilled. 2 Chronicles 36. Now, in case you're saying, well, how could I just turn back toward the book of Genesis when I went to 2 Chronicles? Keep in mind, the Old Testament is not arranged chronologically. If you had a Hebrew Bible and went to the last of your books of the Bible, they would be chronological. You'd be ending up with 2 Chronicles. So 2 Chronicles is the last historically. So chapter 36 and verse 20 and 21. Speaking of the captivity, how in verse, let's go back to 17. It says, therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians, who slew their young men with the sword of the house of their sanctuary, had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hand, and all the articles of the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king and his officers, he brought all down to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all its fortified buildings with fire, destroyed all the valuable articles, and those who escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon. And they were servants to him and to his sons and to the rule of the kingdom of Persia to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. In other words, they made up for every single Sabbath year that they refused. You see, you never, never gain time by disobedience. It can't be done. And I'm sure, what would their thinking be for not allowing that to feel a lie fallow on the seventh year? Obvious reasons. Productivity. I mean, we're doing well. The crops have gone well for 6 years. Why should we not have the produce and the income from the crops? And the answer to that is because God said no. And of course, their thinking would be that, well, perhaps we can get by with it. They did it for 70 years, and God says, you now owe me 70, and you'll be slaves for 70 years. So that is a first major sin of Israel, and it is basically not so much violating the Sabbath as it is God said, do it this way. They didn't do it. Can anyone identify with that? Okay. Number two. The second thing, and these are things that Israel, I'm only putting down three things. Only putting down the things that Israel did immediately upon getting the law. I mean, she just broke her neck as soon as God gave the law to go out and disobey it. And all these things were very early in her career. The second thing is she totally ignored God's prohibition on making covenants with other nations. Totally ignored God's prohibition on covenants. And basically, this is going to be based on some teaching that is going to say, Israel, if you don't run false religion out, you will emulate it. You can't coexist with it. You cannot shake hands with it, and therefore you are to make a covenant with none of these nations, because if you do, you're going to get involved in their paganism. Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23. Israel immediately ignored God's prohibition. But let's see the prohibition first. Exodus 23, verse 24. Talks about when you go into the land, you shall not worship their gods nor serve them, nor do it according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. You can't coexist with idolatry. You've got to do away with it. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. There shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you. Throw into confusion all the people whom you come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you, and so forth. And then come down to what he's going to do to them. Verse 30, I will drive them out before you little by little. Verse 31, I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land. What is the principle? You cannot coexist with false religion. It must be done away. Don't make covenant with these nations. Go over to chapter 34 of Exodus. You've got it again. failure to do this was one of the chief, I would say one of the three chief national sins of Israel. Chapter 34, verse 12. Watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, lest it become a snare in your midst, but rather you are to tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, and cut down their Asherahs. For you shall not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God, lest you make covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and so forth and so forth. You're not to make covenant with them. Deuteronomy 7, when they're getting ready to go into the land, Moses again reviews that prohibition. Chapter 7, verse 1, when the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you're entering to possess it, and shall clear away many nations before you, Hittites, Jergesites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hittites, and Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, and you shall defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. So repeatedly, and those are only sample passages, you are not to make covenant with these nations. Now, what did Israel do? She disobeyed it from the very beginning. Joshua chapter 9. Joshua 9. Verse 14. And we'll not try to lay the context for this. I just simply want to see what happened. Verse 14. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask counsel of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them and let them live. And the leaders' congregation swore an oath to them. So you have, again, the beginning of that. Two other passages, just for samples. Judges 2. Verses 1 and 2. The angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? And then across the page to chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Because of these covenants, verse 5, the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters for themselves as wives, gave their daughters to their sons, and served their gods. Just exactly what God said would happen. Right? That is the second chief national sin that we will see Israel committing. The third. They ignored prohibition on idolatry. They ignored the prohibition of idolatry. One of the three sins for which the nation perished. We're in Judges. Look at chapter 2, verse 11. Through 13. We don't think this prohibition is important. The very first, 5 verses of the Ten Commandments, the basic moral absolutes for the nation, had to do with idolatry. First thing God hit them with up front. But notice in Judges chapter 2, verse 11, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, followed other gods from the gods of the people who are around them, bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. And this is a story of much of the Old Testament. So three very key issues in how Israel totally broke the law by violating the Sabbath year, which she had to make up for 70, ignored the prohibition on covenants with other nations, and ignored the prohibition on idolatry. All right, now let's go back to Exodus 19, and we'll at least have time to get started into the law. And let's say we're going to look, first of all, at the preamble. Exodus 19, 1 through 6. Actually, the first part of it is simply historical. And let's read the historical part down through the first four verses. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle wings and brought you out to myself. Now, and here is basically the preamble to the Constitution beginning in verse 5. But let's say several things. First of all, what do we mean by the preamble? The preamble is the statement of what the Constitution is intended to do. It's a brief statement of what the Constitution is intended to do. Our own preamble to our Constitution tells what the articles of the Constitution or the body of the Constitution is intended to do. And we have this in this section. And basically, he's going to say that the Constitution I've given you has a threefold purpose. Verse 5. Now then, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession. Number one, purpose of the Constitution was to make Israel the unique nation on earth. Not a unique, the unique nation on earth. And that's stated in the early words of the preamble of how different she was to be. When you have in verse 5, you shall be my own possession. My own possession is a very rich word. And it's a word that carries three ideas with it. Number one, it carries the idea of value. Something very valuable. Second, it carries the idea of ownership. And we've got that stressed in verse 5, my own possession. And the reason I'm giving you these other things is because possession is the only thing that our Neo-American emphasizes, which would be ownership, but there's more to that. Value, ownership, and uniqueness. So, if we paraphrase, the purpose of the Constitution is you shall be my own valuable, possessed, unique possession among all the people to make her the unique nation on the earth. What was the chief thing that made her different from everybody else? Nobody else had a revelation of divine absolutes. Israel was the only one. You could call her the nation of the book, even though they didn't use books then, but nonetheless, she was the nation of the book, and that made her different from everybody else. And it is not different today. The one single factor that makes a believer different is the book for his standards and his norms as far as living is concerned. All right, the second purpose, make Israel the unique nation on earth. Second, to make Israel the liaison nation. Is that correct spelling, liaison, L-A-I-S-O-N? Okay. To make her the liaison nation, the go-between nation, the nation which would have the truth through which the rest of the nations could relate to God. And we have that now coming down in verse 6. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests. And of course, the idea of a priest is the idea of a go-between. And the idea is God is going to say, I'm going to give Israel the truth through which other people, when they come in contact with that truth, can come into relationship to God. So it's sort of a mediator-like thing. Here is the Lord, here is the rest of the people, and in between is Israel. Because you see, you didn't get salvation except from Israel's book. The only way of salvation was in the book that God gave to Israel, the revelation that God gave to Israel. So really, in the Old Testament, the only way you could get to God was the Israelite way. And the Israelite way is spelled out as a sacrifice, the death, the go-between, and that sort of a thing. Third, and obviously last, is to make Israel the holy nation. Three things, then, that this Constitution is intended to do. It will make her holy, make her a liaison with the rest. No, it's L-I-A-I, isn't it? Isn't it? I shouldn't use that word. L-I-A-I-S-O-N, liaison. Shouldn't use a word you can't spell. Okay, so the unique nation, three words. Unique, liaison, and holy. And that is what this Constitution is intended to do. All right, we'll get into next time. I'm stopping a little bit early, but I want to keep these separate so that we'll have our mind on the same thing. So we'll pick up in our next study with the moral absolutes on which Israel was based. Father, we're thankful tonight for your truth. We're thankful that you gave to Israel the absolute truths of your word. And we're thankful today that we're even in a better position than they were, because they only had part of that revelation. We have it all. They could only look forward to the perfect sacrifice. We have the perfect sacrifice in Jesus Christ. And therefore, if we look at them and how they failed under enormous privileges, may we recognize the danger for us of failing under much greater privileges in today, the church age. Make us alert to these things, and may we progress through your law and learn it well in Christ's name.